to a pandemic, you have to focus on those individuals who are using the public spaces
And
the
can
most.
You talk about you testing them and the response of unhoused people to you testing them?
Right. So, you know, it's been hard to get testing, you know, if you're not a basketball player, if you're not a rich person. And so literally, we just been going out. And first of all, we did a survey of individuals to see what their symptoms are. And we identified people who needed to be tested. But then, you know, because we are the epicenter of the epidemic, and this is the most vulnerable population, I just figured that we should be testing people at random as well to sample population sizes to see how far, you know, this virus has spread already. And honestly, though, this is supposed to be the city and the county's job in doing this, in providing necessities and testing individuals that are in this vulnerable population. And I think it just speaks to the fact that that I even have to do this. You know, it shouldn't be my job to volunteer out there to make sure that homeless individuals are cared for, you know, especially in a pandemic. So at the surface, it feels like a feel-good story, but it's really not.
Well, Dr. Armin Henderson, I want to ask if you can stay with us for a few more minutes. We're going to continue our conversation about your work with the unhoused and your detention. Dr. Armin Henderson, internal medicine physician, assistant professor of medicine at the University of Miami, handcuffed by the New York by the Miami police. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll put part two at democracynow.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, KBOO will be sticking to our regularly scheduled programming as much as possible, but there are some limitations that we're working with, so we appreciate your understanding and support. We are committed to keeping our staff, volunteers, and programmers safe and healthy, so we are transitioning to producing programs remotely. For updates on KBOO's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, visit our website at kboo.fm/COVID-19. That's kboo.fm/COVID-19.
KBOO.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
Welcome to Wednesday Talk Radio right here on KBOO Portland. And now here's your host, Paul, Sarah, and Jonathan.
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul, and I am in my I'm on a landline from my home in Montevilla neighborhood here in Portland. And we've got hopefully Sarah and Jonathan, I believe, on a microphone on a computer from their home in Northeast Portland. Are you there?
We're here. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. Well, we'll see how this works. It's all an experiment here in a remote talk radio. We're going to be talking about the coronavirus class war. Sarah and Jonathan are my regular. Well, Jonathan's slightly less regular, but Sarah is generally on the third Wednesday of the month. They're with the Portland Assembly Group. And we often talk about class war issues, often having to do with housing situation and other things. I talked about the rent strike on the fourth Wednesday of last month, and in that show, I talked about this wistful idea of a reverse shock doctrine. People are undoubtedly familiar with the idea of the shock doctrine that Naomi Klein has popularized, in which during disasters, the wealthy elites tend to take advantage, seize the situation, and increase their wealth and power, and decrease the wealth and power of the lower classes. So kind of takes off from an article that came out on April 1st in The Nation magazine called "The Coronavirus Class War Has Already Started." A combination of plutocratic bailouts and a physically endangered working class is sparking a new blue-collar militancy. I will eventually read a few paragraphs from this, but I know we talked last time we talked last month, Sarah, you were talking about the PDX COVID-19 Mutual Aid Network, which is one of many, many similar efforts that are sprung up around the nation to as a grassroots effort to reduce the impact on everybody of this deadly pandemic that is upon us. You want to give us a little update on how the Mutual Aid Network is going?
Well, I mean, we're a month in. We have passed out a lot of food boxes.
I'm not hearing you at all in this sense, so I don't know if you're coming out over the radio. We may have to go back to the phone-in idea. There you are.
I think I'm there, yeah. So we're a month in, as of, I believe, yesterday, actually.
No, I'm still not hearing you at all. I think you're going to have to call back on your cell phone.
All right, one moment.
Okay, well, while we're waiting to hear back from Sarah and Jonathan, I am going to read you a little bit from this magazine. It starts out by talking about how catastrophes breed nationalism. There's a perennial impulse to rally together in the face of a common enemy, and that explains... Hello? And that explains Trump's paradox rise in popularity at the onset of this crisis. I'm not sure where he's at with his numbers. Oh. We're going to have to take down that... there's a we have to take down that dial tone.
We run into some technical difficulties, and we'll be right back.
Hi, who's this? Is Paul?
Okay, Sarah, hold on just one second, okay? Sarah, are you with us?
I am, hi.
Hi, Sarah. We're trying to get Paul. Paul lost connection, too, so if you want to just...
Absolutely. So, Paul was talking about the rising class war, which we see as always having existed. And that's what we've always kind of talked about on our shows. Is this sort of heightened crisis in capitalism, which is now laid very, very stark for everybody. It's kind of interesting to see the sort of escalation, the rapid escalation. We're seeing, you know, everybody's waiting for their stimulus checks, and the rich are getting bailout checks at $1.7 million, I believe, this morning. So
I think we have everybody back now.
More heightened. Hey everybody, are we all here?
Yeah, sounded good. Go ahead, keep going with what you were saying.
So I'm just saying it's nothing new, but it's now something that everybody can see. That thing that we talk about, that Americans are generally no less than a paycheck away from real crisis, financial crisis, and this has really brought that to light for everybody. We see how many people and how unsustainable this type of unbalanced economy really is. You know, if people are, if 30% of people are forced to rent strike, I mean, there are so many people who are not doing it for political reasons, but we would love to bring them along because we can all be doing it for political reasons. This is a tool we can use against the oligarchy, you know?
So that 30-40%, is that a local figure and not nationwide figure?
No, nationwide.
Uh-huh.
Was what I read. Second, I think like last week that came out. I'll see if I can find it to attach to the page.
Okay.
It's supposed to be worse this month too. Coming up.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So talk about the organizing. Obviously, is continuing on the rent strike. It's going to be a continuing thing.
Yeah, it actually is. It's going to be more of a community-powered effort, from what I understand. Also, where they're hoping to have an eviction defense network that's run by people in the community who are all kind of shared this you know circumstance. Which actually, there's precedent for a class action lawsuit against landlords who are using different corporate shells, like we've been talking about, that happened in New York a couple of years ago. So that's kind of adding fuel to the fire.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I mean, you all are a lot more active, engaged in directly in politics and in community efforts than I am. So I tend to get, probably like a lot of people, I get to feel a little bit disempowered by everything that's going on, which is kind of scary and kind of overwhelming. And so usually the best antidote for that is to actually get active. And so I you know, at least at the level of a talk show host, I seized on that idea. It seemed really brilliant to me, the idea of a rent strike as something people can actually do, you know, stay sheltering in place and actually, you know, in by adding up all the people who are doing it, actually make some difference. That's kind of inspiring to me.
Mm-hmm. It's a great opportunity to really, like, throw a wrench in the works and show how this economy does not work for the vast majority of people.
But of course, obviously, you get the same dynamic where, in any kind of attempt at large scale social change, where people are hesitant to stick their neck out and do it because we're also isolated, and we, you know, unless we're all organized doing it together, which is, as we all know, difficult in this culture and economic system, so. Go a little bit more into that. You see that it's actually getting some legs, this idea of not paying the rent in a way to sort of force a crisis in the sort of the artificial system of property and rent and such.
Well, it's gaining some legs, but it's because people don't have a choice. Like, that's mm-hmm. why this is such an opportune moment, is because all of our necks are out. Like, there is no protection at this point. And realizing that we have to build it for ourselves is something that a lot more people are, like, an experience that a lot more people are having right now. That sort of sudden realization that the government, the federal government, is not going to help us. $1,200 for most people is less than a month's rent in this economy. So unless, you know, we can't see that as anything but a direct bailout to landlords, we should not respond to that by bailing out those landlords. And it's really a laughable response. We see more support coming from our communities every day. I mean, even before this, people were raising more money for each other's medical bills on GoFundMe than we could ever expect to get from our government. We have to, like, really point out that this is the time that our communities are coming together to support each other and to do things that the federal government isn't going to and doesn't want to and can't.
Mm-hmm. So maybe, I don't know if you got the chance to talk about that when I got my line got cut off, but did you talk about the PDX Mutual Aid Network?
A little bit. We all kind of got cut off at the same time, I think. So we have given out, I think we're up to 300 food boxes a week at this point. we are, and we're still increasing those numbers. We are doing direct request fulfillment, so we're matching volunteers to people with needs and getting those needs taken care of. It's working out really well. We're implementing new systems all the time as more people come into the organizing group and suggest things that make our jobs easier and make it easier for people to connect directly. It's a really great sort of experience to watch happen because it is so many like community groups and members really just offering what they can.
Mm-hmm. And again, so that's a PDX COVID-19 Mutual Aid Network as a on the Facebook. Did you end up getting a phone number?
No, we're not on the phone, but so let me give you, hang on 1 second, and let me give you our link tree, which has all of the links to both the fundraisers, lets you sign up to volunteer, lets you sign up for aid. The link tree page is what I'm...
PDX Mutual Aid. Linktree/PDX Mutual Aid.
Okay, so well, if you all can give me whatever information you want on the program page, I'll put what you just said and anything else on there after this show. Okay. So again, the phone number is 503-231-8187 to call into this show, not to get involved in Mutual Aid Network, although you might get more hints if you want to talk about that, or you want to talk about your experiences. If you are involved in the rent strike, we'd like to hear from you. If you'd like to just talk about the idea of the coronavirus class war. As I said, we're sort of coming off of a coronavirus article in The Nation from April 1st called "The Coronavirus Class War Has Already Started." As I said, I'll probably eventually read some of the paragraphs. But it's a really, let's talk a little bit more about what's going on. Obviously, you know, I talked about the idea of a shock doctrine in which, you know, sort of the neoliberal model basically sort of was ushered in through, you know, in Chile and in lots of other places. Generally, either out of a coup d'etat, which is certainly a very shocking thing, or other forms of economic warfare, and usually the public sphere is shrunk. We see that the post office is now threatened with disappearing potentially, which has grave consequences both for all the people who work for that great venerable institution and for voting by mail, which we do here in Oregon. Talk about some of the other things that are going on under the cover of this coronavirus.
Well, real quick, you mentioned it briefly a little bit earlier when we were talking about the rent strike, but the integration of this bailout, this kind of piecemeal bailout that's occurring, because I don't know if you saw that article about the millionaires getting all the money that their stimulus package is, like $1.7 million windfall or something like that.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you already have all of this offshore money from what we've been talking about through this real estate laundering practice at the national level even, right? So that kind of brings it all together to where the rents are a very critical focus, because that was their profit mechanism for all of these derivatives and so on. So if you look at Blackstone, they're looking to take out as many loans as they can because they see the credit crunch coming too. Everybody sees it in the business world. And so, like, they're probably not in the best shape either. And now that we remember that all of our public service employees have their retirement tied up in Blackstone, $4 billion worth of PERS or whatever it was, when Blackstone goes under, like, what do you think happens to that money? It's just like the mortgage-backed securities thing. And if it goes poof, you know, it was all speculation. It was all based on Blackstone doing more and more business. So,
well, and what a trick to have convinced us to put all of that public funding into a private equity market, and now there is pressure from people who have a real interest in destroying that market to normalize and to pay rents and things like that. So they managed to put us in a position where we are played against each other as the not super wealthy And they, again, walk off with the bag.
Indeed, indeed. But we here at KBOO are doing our utmost to resist this from the ground up, and talk radio is one of the ways we get together in the public sphere and talk about it, and you can do so too by calling 503-231-8187. And I'm Paul. This is I'm the regular weekly host of Wednesday Talk Radio. I have various co-hosts on other days. On the third Wednesday, it's Sarah and Jonathan from Portland Assembly, and they are talking at us from their home, as I am from my home. So, let me just go ahead and read a little bit of this article. I think it gives a little bit of the broader context. So, as I said, it starts out by talking about the way that catastrophes breed nationalism, and people often tend to unify, sometimes very paradoxically, under an even unpopular leader in these times. And Trump is obviously playing his daily briefing as a way to strangely sort of keep his name out there, even though he's being so thoroughly discredited on the basis of the facts in his dealing with the coronavirus. But anyway, it says, yet the national unity produced by the crisis can be a deceptive facade. Even during the patriotic fervor of World War II, the social divisions of normal times didn't end. Detroit during wartime witnessed both wildcat strikes from auto workers who felt they were being asked to make sacrifices without fair compensation, and race riots from whites who used violence to stem the migration of blacks coming from the South. The coronavirus crisis is showing a similar intensification of social strife. Racist attacks on Asian Americans are spiking, thanks in no small part to Donald Trump's embrace of the phrase China virus. The class war is also becoming fiercer. There is actually a two-pronged class war going on. Among the rich and their allies in both political parties, the crisis offers an opportunity to loot the treasury. And of course, an aside, Donald Trump is now apparently putting his name on these $1,000 checks or whatever, no comment on that. The stimulus packages, I continue, that have passed or are being contemplated are all designed to lock in the privileged position of the existing rich, with only limited efforts made to soften the blow of the recession on the working class majority. At the same time, blue-collar workers are expected to work in dangerous conditions with little compensation. Many of these same workers are being squeezed by furloughs, pay cuts, and layoffs. And I'll just add as an addendum, the impact on people of color by this coronavirus and poor people, often the same, is due to underlying health conditions, aka economic conditions, also due to the fact that a lot of them work in these so-called essential jobs, where people are forced to keep working and often not giving proper protective gear. For example, I think they said in Oregon, Hispanics have 22% of the cases and are only 13% of the population. Anyway, let me just read one more paragraph here. The combination of plutocratic bailouts and increasing precariousness and physical danger for the working class is an explosive one. It's hard to see how it can last long without a breakdown of the social order. Maybe I'll continue later on, but want to take it off from there?
I mean, that coming class war fervor has been on my mind. That in particular about the correlation of all of the kind of like propaganda coming about out of this also is really tactful, because Steve Mnuchin is the guy who's the head of the Treasury, I believe, and he's basically gutted the finance regulatory departments. And so right now everything is definitely like fire sale prices as well. So it's just that it advantages private equity at the expense of black and brown people, because that's how they've made their money since the beginning of colonialism, like we talked about before. But now you can see it in real time, because they do not care about something that affects people's mortality in real time. And I think that's making it way more visceral for people, and way more guillotine posts have been made lately. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot less sympathy with the landlord class as a whole. And I think that's an interesting position folks who still see themselves as middle class to be pushed into. And I think that there's a lot of conflict there, because I am seeing that a lot of these, you know, homeowners, especially people who have bought second properties to make income off of, mm-hmm. are recognizing that that's unsustainable, and are able to admit, actually, that was perhaps not a market that should have been pushed, and that, you know, in order to actually rectify this, like, imagine if Oregon were to pull its money out of those purse funds, or its purse funds out of those private equity companies at this point. If we pulled real materials out and left them with these worthless properties, like, there are ways that we could turn this around, but it necessitates sort of the so-called middle class realizing that they are more on our side than they are on the side of the rich. And because of the way that the virus has laid bare sort of societal response to this, it's a lot more clear where everybody stands, you know?
Specifically with, you know, following up with what was on Democracy Now! About that officer in Miami who arrested that black doctor who was volunteering to help the houseless people and feed them, and had no protective gear, yelling in his face, blah, blah, blah. We've heard, like, how many percentage of police officers? I guess there's a silver lining there, maybe, but, like, these guys also don't care, and they're going around inspecting everybody. It was, like, the photo op that they took, the Portland PD, where they were, like, delivering donuts to the children's hospital. Like, no mask, no nothing, like...
Well, and I've also seen plenty of footage from the street where people are... where sweeps are still occurring. Police are still in Portland harassing houseless people who are attempting to shelter in place, and they are doing so without protective gear. They are doing so barehanded sometimes, unless, you know, things escalate, and had to be ordered by the chief of police to mask up. And we see, like, police are vectors in New York. How many police tested positive? They're spreading this. And, like, to have non-essential contacts made with members of the community by a police force that is not properly trained or given the right gear is an exacerbation of the normal danger that police pose.
Yeah.
I'm just getting a message from...
Also, right?
I'm getting a message from my board op that we're, I didn't realize you guys are both on your own individual phones, which is actually a situation I was trying to avoid because it means we can't have any callers.
Oh, I can hop off for a while.
Well, I guess you can't do a conference call.
Well,
you two?
That's what we were doing before, and you said you couldn't hear us, so...
Oh, I thought it was on. I thought it was. Oh, yeah. It was terrible quality. I mean, I assume if it was bad quality, I hear it was even worse on a radio. I guess we'll just continue as it is. People can actually go to my Facebook page. I think it's a KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. I think you'll have to like it.
One of us will just hang up and we'll put it on speaker so that we can both talk.
Okay, why don't you do that, and hopefully that'll free up one line for calling
we
in.
Talk to the community.
Yeah.
What was that?
Okay. So.
All right. You have to turn that down. There we go.
Is this
so,
Paul?
What'd you say, Michael?
Okay. Paul, we've got both of them on the line.
Okay. So so can we quit callers or not?
Hi there.
Stephanie, are you
take
there?
A call?
What's that?
Can you take a phone call?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll just launch right in. I just wanted to recommend to everybody, in Monthly Review about 20 years ago, Professor Richard Levins wrote an article titled, Is Capitalism a Disease? And he specialized, I believe, in public health. And it's just an incredible article. I think Monthly Review... Are you still there?
Mm-hmm.
Monthly Review has reprinted this article, Is Capitalism a Disease? And I just think everyone would really... get a lot out of it. But anyway, the reason I called today, I really appreciate your conversation this morning, but I'm wondering, is anyone else running into the scissor bill mentality? I know, like, scissor bill is an old IWW slang term for workers that don't believe there's any need for class consciousness or unions or things like that. I've been running into this mentality where, like, people still don't get it. They think if you want to be in solidarity with your community and with fellow workers, that you're some sort of Stalinist Borg. Like, there's this whole idea of, like, differentiating yourself and not being part of the herd. It's like this disease of hyper-individualism. It's like the opposite of solidarity. And I think it relates a little bit to what you're talking about with the whole rent strike idea or just general strikes in general. You know what I mean? Like, if we ever do go on general strike, the whole scissor bill attitude and mentality, I wonder if your guests could comment on that a little bit. Thanks.
Thanks for calling in.
We have Sarah back on the line, too, as well.
Jonathan, Sarah?
Yep. Okay. So I think that yeah, that's definitely an issue that's seen pretty consistently sort of in worker organization. And it's that American individualism thing, which is really, like, clearly proving the lie at this point. I mean, there is so much more happening for people through mutual aid networks than there is through the government at this point. If people's unions were actually, like, online doing what they needed, you would be getting more out of your union now than you would from the federal government. I can't really... Honestly, I tend to pull away from worker-centered politics because I think that they erase a lot of folks who exist outside of that paradigm. So houseless people, people who are in prison, the ultra poor are not considered part of that movement. And I think that one of the things that might help at this point is if those unionist movements were to expand and include the rights of people who they would not consider workers. I think it's a little myopic, to be honest, and I think it actually pushes class divide in ways that are unhelpful. So at this point, it really is us and them, and we have to recognize that. Like, we are not temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Like, even if you own a house, you are not on the level of the people who are making the decisions and calling the shots. And they are not making these decisions with your best interests in mind.
That was a really good setup, if I could reply a little bit, because that's also, I've been inspired by Fred Moten a lot lately. Specifically, the undercommons applies here, because I think, as Paul said before, where you don't have a choice in the matter as far as rent striking goes, it becomes more of a war of positionality, and thereby identifying with these positions as their inherent qualities, like, come with them, being houseless, being no income, not having any real stake in this current economy. That's where you start to see these new formations of how to live coming out and people willing to try things. And it's really inspiring, for one, but also heavily discounted through traditional Marxist language. And nobody really needs to hear that anymore, in my opinion. So,
agreed.
Yeah, there's a need to progress the narrative beyond these things as well. And beyond work itself, we can talk about things without having to work. People shouldn't have to work to live, basically. There shouldn't be a guarantee or a requirement to work in order to get the things you need to live.
Yeah, so if we focus our political action there or social action there, we're leaving out a lot. And especially at a time like this where we actually have an opportunity to sort of re-examine societal values and consider, you know, what is essential? Like, is the iPhone store essential? Is my local market essential are these restaurants that are, say, opening their kitchens to help feed people at this point. Isn't that more essential to the community than a real estate broker or an Uber headquarters? Like, Uber, which is consistently endangering and underpaying its workers throughout this. Like, are these major corporations that clearly don't care about us, that won't give grocery workers masks to wear, are they our priorities at the end of this, or are we our priorities? Like, do we build things that we want and sustain things that we that serve our community?
Because they're already rent striking. Just saying, they don't pay their rent right now. A lot of these people.
Yeah, that's true. Like, the corporate discount goes deep right now, and they are forgiving things right and left at very high levels of the economy. But your landlord is asking you to detail your weekly budget if you're not going to pay your rent. So there's a real discrepancy here, and we would do well to pay attention to it.
Well, I must apologize for the series of loud dial tones and stuff. We're, again, this is an experiment in remote radio, talk radio, so we are not all together in the same studio, and we're not communicating directly with the board operator and various other things. So apologies to anybody who was a little dismayed by that. But we are back on track here. And I was just looking up the definition of scissor bill, which the caller called in. It's, I don't know, it's interesting. I know Jonathan and Sarah, too, you could probably riff on this. I think it's important, this sort of underground history that people like Howard Zinn wrote about and others, the labor history, which we tend to not know much about. But anyway, it's a worker indifferent to the interests of the laboring class as one unwilling to join a union. And he mentioned the IWW. And, of course, the times were radically different back then. The idea of social and labor solidarity meant something very different. And it was, in fact, out of those heated pitched labor battles that came, you know, the what is called the historic compromise between the sort of the official administrators of labor and the ruling class, which basically resulted in a lot of legislation that made it much more difficult to strike, a lot of emphasis solely on incremental pay increases rather than any kind of real control in the workplace, any kind of radical critique of the capitalist system, and we're still living in that. You want to take off on that?
Oh, I mean, that neoliberal culture of the market will solve everything is deeply entrenched in some people that I work with. I work in light manufacturing stuff, so it's kind of very macho in that mentality. But that to circle back to what the caller was kind of asking about, how do you get through those people? In my experience, everybody there doesn't necessarily have a political opinion. They don't want to talk about it at all. You don't want to rock the boat. But if you ask them about gardening, or if you ask them about, you know, where the free store is, or like how you do certain, you know, handmade craft things, there are certain inroads to those people's lives that are not fulfilled at all by this kind of workaday existence. And so what we really are questioning now is that whole modality of economic rationality, where you have to make all these choices about your budget and blah, blah, and you put in your pension, and like, those are your focuses on how you grow your wealth, and that's the only way to do it. That internalization of the market has started to kind of break apart in people's psyche, which is good, because that does change things as far as the turf that you're trying to play on.
Mm-hmm. So again, we have about 20 minutes left. I'm Paul, and you just heard Jonathan, and Sarah is also with us. We're talking about the coronavirus class war. Talk a little bit more about, I mean, it's such an incredibly complex phenomenon, and so fast, it happens so fast and is so wide-reaching that, you know, it's hard to really get our heads around what's happening. And we're all so separated, too, except, you know, of course, there's the Internet, which I guess is a sort of blessing, because we can actually continue to be in touch with each other. And there's KBOO Radio. But so many people are losing their work. I mean, what's going to? It's really mind-boggling what's going to come out of all this.
Well, if I may, just because what is coming out of this already, I think, is this a massive amount of time that a lot of people are having, but a lot of people are also at the margins being, you know, kind of crushed by this inactivity. So there's a nice kind of even sight line people have to where the stopping of the economy creates visceral problems. And that's a shock that we haven't necessarily gotten to see before, because this is a worldwide pandemic that kind of moved across different countries, and we had to have international solidarity because of it. You know, medical professionals really stepping up and sharing info is really, really, really a good thing. And look at us, the U.S., doing this market thing again, where we try to sell our own medicine, we try to make our own tests, we stop funding the World Health Organization. And so if you look at globally, like what we're doing, like I want someone who's good at finance, I guess, to call in, and who knows more about the markets and so on, because what I've been seeing is that they're just pumping now. They basically turned on the tap to the money supply at the federal level, at the Federal Reserve level, and have all of these holes in the bucket of the money supply in the economy, where they're just being dumped out into the fucking, into the Caymans, or into the outside of, you know, the U.S. bank accounts that all these people have, while we all get stimulus checks that last not even a month. And so it seems like there is an attrition to the economy that is becoming obvious, where the whole thing they use to build up the value is what we're all sitting on. Like the rentals and so on that are accessible to people in their cities are the banks. They're the land banks. They're land banks for all of these rich guys' investments that are now moving elsewhere, like the $20 billion deal we talked about Blackstone did with Saudi Arabia, and like what Saudi Arabia is doing now. Like they can just sit on this because they can produce oil for years. And so they're plummeting that price too.
Well, and this is a really great moment to examine just how far up, like, the unsustainability of the economy goes, right? So if your landlord can't afford the house you live in without your rent payments, then who owns that house?
You're paying their rent.
Like, who's paying whose rent there?
Yeah.
And if the mortgage company that your landlord is indebted to for that house can't pay for that house to the major equity company that it bought that bundle from, or that it sold that bundle to, then who owns it? Like, we're the ones that occupy these places. We're the people who live here. We're the people who take care of these places. We're the people who, well, we're the people, like, the actual people who need homes.
Yeah. And this is kind of the exact thing we've been talking about. This is a grand opportunity for an anti-capitalist project in Portland. We need more land decommodification. We need more free food. We need more access to medicine. There just needs to be that kind of independent autonomous network that's meeting these needs now, but more stable and more standardized and more integrated to what we actually value.
Looks like we have a caller named Barry, so let's let Barry have his say. Go ahead, Barry.
You remember about four Saturdays ago, the memorial service for Clayton Margaridge. Now, you talk about economy and economics and stuff like that, capitalism. This guy knew so much, you know, that was on KBOO. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, but do you have a question relevant to the current conversation?
Well, could you discuss him and his economic views, just maybe...
That's not what we're talking about. We'll have to let you go, Barry. Thank you for calling, though. Appreciate it. One thing I want to talk about, Clayton Mortgage, a great person. I don't particularly have a handle on his particular views, although I think he probably would share a lot about what we're talking about this morning. One thing I wanted to mention, you know, we're in electoral season. Electoral politics is a whole big subject, but I just want to bring that into it in the sense that the more and more vicious voter suppression that is going on, and again, also under the cover of the coronavirus, we're going to see more and more of that. I watched a documentary called, I think, Kill Chain was just on HBO about just the mind-boggling manipulability of these computerized voting machines. So it's the prospects are very scary. Of course, just the tried and true techniques of gerrymandering and taking people off the rolls and not letting prisoners vote. But as far as it seems to me that the margins of the worldwide capitalist system are getting so flimsy. The ability of the system to keep itself afloat is so based upon these really wilder and wilder speculative schemes, more and more manipulative speculative schemes. It seems the system is just sort of spinning more and more into these ethereal realms that they know, the people, Republican Party being more or less closer to the wealthy elites, although obviously the Democrats are unfortunately controlled too, that they are having to resort to more and more extreme measures to stay in power. I compare them more and more to like the Afrikaners, holding on desperately to white power in South Africa. It seems like it's more and more that is becoming more and more evident. And so it seems like the need for them to maintain their hold on power is becoming more and more evident. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. But I also think that the sort of disconnect between the electoral voting process and that power is becoming more and more evident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are really pretty disenchanted, I would say, with electoral politics at this point, especially on a federal level, which is a beautiful sight for me to see, because I would love if we in America could progress beyond the point of thinking that voting is engaging in politics or has anything to do with social change, you know? I mean, I guess it does, but it has the least to do with social change, in my opinion. Like, if you are not actively addressing the way that you live and the way that you interact with the people around you and your community, then you can vote all you want and it's not gonna ever change anything. So I would love to see people actually recognize that and change the way they live and actually like make their lives what they think that they should be, because that's how we actually make change from the ground up. Is that, you know, I look around and I see the things that I can't live with, and so I set about to change them.
And mm-hmm. I would want to point out, it's kind of exciting for me that their money is becoming more and more useless to people. So the more and more they hoard it, the more and more they take it offshore, the more and more it goes elsewhere to benefit them, the less and less value it has to us because it's not accessible at all. So all of these stimulus packages, the thing that got me about it was that, the 1.7 million, it says that there's 43,000 taxpayers who will each get that, who already earn $1 million. So this wealth stratification is now intensifying. We're sailing down the path towards fascism. Capitalism, when it becomes more austere, tends towards fascism, right? There's a history. So it looks like it's a guaranteed Trump presidency. I don't think he's going to get any better.
At the same time, as just to push back a little bit, one thing that really informed my view on the relationship between like institutional power or people in institutional roles and more grassroots radical activism was in this movement against this high-speed train line in Italy, in northwest Italy, trying to connect the Italian, very corrupt, extremely corrupt Italian high-speed train system, which I won't go into, and the existing French system. Anyway, this whole valley rose up against it, and it was a total grassroots effort in which there was like a general strike happened. You know, the committees in every town in the valley were very active and meeting. There's a general assembly process. It was hundreds and hundreds of people would participate in. It was really remarkable. But the town mayors and councils were almost unanimously, I can't remember how many towns there were, 14 or something, were in opposition, and they often were actually on the front lines at the height of it when they're trying to come in and start this project, and there are actually barricades going on. And they actually had the town mayors and council people wearing their official tricolor sashes, like on the front lines. And it was an inspirational moment where you actually could see the possibility where people in institutional roles actually took that role seriously as a role of actually being with and helping to protect the interests of their own communities. Of course, it all ended up breaking up, you know, over the years because of pressures from outside and contradictions inside, which, you know, often or almost always happens. But I just want to draw the analogy to, you know, people like our governor and our town administrations, which are, you know, making policies that are in the interests of protecting the health of the public, and doing that in a very conscious and against, in some ways, you know, the quote, the exclusive economic interests or whatever. And of course, you know, it probably only goes so far, but I think it's valuable to see that as a possibility that we can actually, you know, make temporary alliances that could lead to something more.
I mean, do you have local examples of politicians that are actually stepping up and doing that? Because honestly, like, as somebody who works in houseless outreach, the response on the ground has been pretty disappointing.
Isn't Blumenauer pushing the COVID Mutual Aid Network as like a top resource?
Yeah, Blumenauer is great though. Like, I have voted for Earl Blumenauer in literally every election I've ever been able to vote in. And you know, and I definitely like do see that sometimes local politicians can help. I suppose that is a pathway that exists. I just unfortunately do not see it a lot. And when I do see it, it tends to be in sort of co-option and recuperation of grassroots projects, yeah, which are then made inaccessible by layers of bureaucracy. So, like, I might be a little cynical at this point, but I have come through my era of working with politicians in that way, because I think that it will almost always, your efforts will almost always be tainted by profit needs. Now that cities and state governments are for-profit businesses, that is always going to be part of the equation.
Arguably, they were always for-profit investments.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Like,
well, this is a
money-making potentials of the settler state. Yeah.
This is a bigger and longer conversation, but looks like we got another caller. Sean is on the line. Go ahead, Sean.
Good morning. Hey, I wanted to ask your guests, if the minimum wage had been tied to the rate of inflation, I guess minimum wage would be something like $26 an hour now. I wanted to ask your guests, are they able to get away with printing all of this money? Because in essence, it's a wealth transfer with quote-unquote flexible labor markets, unionization rates being so low, minimum wage being so low. They're able to get away with printing all this money and giving it to the wealthy without causing hyperinflation because of our quote-unquote flexible labor markets. If you have any comments, thanks.
Well, one thing that's interesting, I was just reading an article that, at least in Oregon, so there's a provision where people are getting $600 a week for unemployment if they've been laid off because of COVID-19. Now, that is considerably more than our grocery store employees make. That is considerably more than minimum wage. I feel like that conflict needs to be heightened, and we need to pay attention to that. If our government can sustain us at $600 a week, then what are we doing working for $7.25 an hour?
Well, that's what's so frustrating. Our leverage has never been greater, and yet there doesn't seem to be a class-conscious force to seize and use this leverage. Dylan Radigan, the financial journalist, said something like, the $1,200 payment is like the cheese in the mousetrap, and we're all about to get our heads crushed in because this is an extraction of wealth from all the working class and poor people in this country directly into the bank accounts of the super wealthy. And there's no, I just can't understand why, you know, we don't have a yellow vest situation right now. A mass general strike, because this should be the time of our most potent leverage. So I'll get off the line. Thank you.
I mean, I agree with you, Sean. That's definitely what we think would be great. And I kind of feel the pulse of it. I don't think it'll have a name, and it'll often not really be precipitated by much. But it's funny because, like, I'm a real nerd about it, and it's bothered me for a long time. Since the last crash, actually. Since the last crash pretty much ruined all my early 20s, actually. Was pretty much horrible because of unemployment and bad stuff that happened in Florida, the amount of real estate scams that kind of rocked the economy for quite a while. And so now that's exactly what they've done. They've turned on the money tap that's basically signed off by our government, and it's going right into their bank accounts, and we're going to become further and further pauperized because of it, and our money will become more and more irrelevant. A lot of the big capitalist guys are up there going like, oh, this is how we become the Weimar Republic. Like, these venture capitalist investors who have millions of dollars invested in this economy are screaming this. So
it actually kind of goes back to the earlier caller who was talking about sort of like the IWW spoon bills and the workerist movement, is that, like, to be honest, that's where it should come from, right? Like, a lot of that push would have historically come out of that sector, but union organizing has become so enmeshed with, again, with profit, with businesses. There are so many, you know, corporations that are say asking their union reps to make their employees feel more comfortable coming to work in an unsafe environment rather than addressing that unsafe environment, right? So, like, these groups that historically worked for the public are kind of now working against the public. So it's not like those groups aren't trying to elevate that consciousness, right? Like, the media is no longer really aimed at elevating our awareness of what's going on. Like, I mean, the fact that I was about to mention Teen Vogue as a good site for some of this analysis,
I love Teen Vogue,
really is telling. Like, you're not going to get it from the economic analysis that we would expect to get it from, because those people are all bought out and those sources are all controlled by money.
I've been wondering what's up with Teen Vogue anyway.
Read it. It's pretty great.
I know. I get articles regularly on my Facebook feed that are really rad, and it's bizarre. But anyway, we only have a couple minutes left. Let's see. We've got Mitch. He says he can be really quick because we only have a couple minutes left. Go ahead, Mitch.
Just very sorry that what didn't come up in the conversation yet is yesterday's article in Common Dreams, where the Treasury has given a green light to the banks to divert the $1,200 going into direct deposited into taxpayer funds as part of the stimulus to pay debts to those banks. So the banks, if you owe your bank money on the credit card or your personal line of credit, even unsecured loans by the banks now have the ability to divert the $1,200. So people won't even be getting it. They'll just be seeing a debit.
I've been poor long enough that I just assumed that that would be happening.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a surprise. They'll take that money back any way they can. If you're not going to give it to your landlord, they'll take it for your like old parking tickets, whatever they can.
Yeah.
Not your money. None of it's our money.
If you're looking for a yellow vest movement, this is what's going to do it, and that's why there's been very little mass media attention paid to it. So I just wish someone at KBU would refer to it. I'm glad Common Dreams did.
Yeah, that's definitely a big proponent for general strike, in my opinion.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Mitch. Yeah, I hadn't come across that article myself, but thanks for putting that out there. We got about a minute or two left. Last thoughts, another plug for the Mutual Aid Network or anything else?
Oh, yeah. Find our link tree, which is lnktree.com. Nope, there's no I. And it's PDX COVID-19 Mutual Aid. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can sign up to support. You can sign up to, hang on one second. You can sign up to get help if you need deliveries of medication or food, whatever. And once again, sorry, the address is linktr.ee/PDX Mutual Aid.
Okay, and I will endeavor to put those links on the program page, which I am going to develop today. Another resource is the COVID-19 Portland, Oregon Area Community Support. There's a lot of good discussion on there. Any other places where people are talking about this sort of thing?
I mean, all over.
Yeah. Where aren't they? One last thing I'd want to plug is definitely reach out to your New York friends if you have any, and reach out to people who might be dealing with this in places where it's real bad, because we're kind of lucky here. But also, this is a lesson to be learned from how the Panthers organized too, because they didn't give, you know, they weren't looking towards class consciousness through worker movements either. They were looking at serving the people on the street, and that's how we're going to get this done.
Right on. Okay, well, with that, I think that's the last word. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your regular host, Paul Rowan, and you are listening also to Sarah and Jonathan on the third Wednesday talk show. Thank you all.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH.